the defendants asked for an instruction, the negative element instruction in the elements of first-degree murder, asking that the state would have to prove that it was not, the murder was not based upon a sudden quarrel with sufficient provocation. This court in Morgan said that the absence of a sudden quarrel is not an element of first-degree murder, and in Chavez said that the jury must have necessarily rejected the idea that there's a sudden quarrel without malice. The question is, how does that square with an earlier case, State versus Trice? The State versus Trice, which was a second-degree murder case, this court said that provocation upon sudden quarrel negates malice. Clearly, malice is an element of first-degree murder. So somehow, in a first-degree murder case, if there is a sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation, the jury needs to understand that malice would be negated by this sudden quarrel with sufficient provocation. And how do we do that other than some kind of negative element in the elements of first-degree murder, which this court has not particularly been fond of, or some kind of instruction in the definition stating, as Trice says, that malice is negated by sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation.
How would this affect the factual situation in which the defendant planned the murder? Premeditated, he planned the murder, he knew that he was going to go to this place and kill this particular individual. How would a sudden quarrel affect that issue if he planned to kill this person?
And certainly that's the premeditation in first-degree murder. But the classic, I guess, scenario for sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation in voluntary manslaughter looks a lot like premeditated murder. The classic scenario, I think, the case I cite in my brief, State versus Rinker, in that case, the defendant takes a knife, goes out looking for his wife, who he believes is having an affair, goes to the house of the victim, goes in, finds his wife with two men who are both naked on the bed, pulls out the knife, and attacks one and kills one. Certainly that looks like a lot like premeditated murder, but that's also sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation when you find your spouse in bed with two other men. So that's how I think it relates to the idea, whether it is this premeditated, somebody's going out to plan to kill somebody, certainly that's first-degree murder. But when there's this sufficient provocation, the jury needs to be told that that would negate the element of malice, because again, the two can look very similar. And the jury needs to be properly instructed about that, that the malice element in first-degree murder can't be negated if there's sufficient provocation.
How do you explain that, negating malice?
I think either as an instruction saying the state has to prove it wasn't sudden quarrel in the elements of first-degree murder, or simply as was requested in this case, in the definition, including the terms that malice is negated by sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation.
So in plain speak, someone could set out, premeditate, plan a murder that might be called a first-degree murder. Is that right?
Right.
But something happens, and that plan goes off track, and instead a separate set of facts ensues. Is that how it works in real life?
That's not really my argument. I think if you plan to go commit a murder, you know, premeditated with intent, and I'm going to go to this place and kill this person, that's first-degree premeditated murder. I don't think sudden quarrel based upon sufficient provocation plays into that.
So let me understand this then. There has to be some scintilla of evidence of a provocation before you would be entitled to a portion of the instruction saying provocation negates malice?
There would have to be something to show that there's this provocation. I think one of the issues, for example, in State versus Morgan, there was no evidence that there was any kind of provocation that would have a normal person lose self-control. In this case, there was certainly evidence of that.
And what was it, jealousy?
Well, in this case, Mr. Henderson had a relationship with the victim for a couple of years. They lived together. While they were living together, she married somebody else. A week later, he finds out about this, and then she moves out. He goes over there, by his testimony, to threaten the man that she had married, thinking she was not going to be there. Finds she's there, becomes upset, ramps his car into another vehicle, goes in, and at some point, after he shoots through a door, opens the door and finds that someone has been killed and sees the woman he was in a relationship naked, believing that she wasn't going to be there.
So sudden, I'm still back where I was. a sudden provocation develops.
It develops. For example, in this case, the testimony from
Mr. Is that Mr. what Hansen, the evidence would have to show to get on board?
I think so. He goes there not with the intent to kill somebody, but to threaten this person. Once he's there, he's provoked by the fact that the woman is there when she said she wasn't going to be, finds them together.
Well, let me back up a little bit. What if the evidence was sufficient for a jury to find that the defendant set out not just to threaten, but set out to commit a first-degree murder in the classic premeditated sense?
I think that is
a jury would, if there was evidence to support that.
I think that's
would you then get off that and morph into a sudden provocation?
If the jury were to have found that the person is going with the intent to kill, the classic first-degree murder, that's a factual issue for the jury. Obviously, whatever facts would show that, they would determine that themselves. But if there is any evidence of the sudden provocation, then the jury should be allowed to consider that.
How do you get that evidence in of a sudden provocation? Do you have to have the defendant testify?
You don't have to, but certainly in this case, he did.
If the only witnesses to the crime were the defendant, how else would you prove that it was a sudden provocation if the defendant didn't testify?
Certainly there could be other witnesses there.
I said if there were not. And there aren't other witnesses in this case, are there?
But there aren't in this case, certainly.
Did the defendant testify?
Pardon me?
Did the defendant testify?
He did testify.
Okay, so he's raising an issue that I didn't intend to go over there and kill him. I went over there just to scare these people or whatever. And when I went in there, something snapped and I shot them both.
Something happened that's, I think his testimony was, I lost it when he saw that she was there.
Well, how does that square with our case law that says that premeditation can be a very, very small period of time?
Almost instantaneous, and uh-huh. that's obviously language that I have a problem with, that we have objected to.
That really strengthens your argument, doesn't it? Because if the evidence were that he had planned this for 2 months, you wouldn't maybe get to the issue that it was a sudden provocation if he'd been planning it for 2 months. But if it's on the spur of the moment, then your argument is, I didn't intend to kill him, something snapped. And the state's argument is, well, premeditation can be just a second before you killed him. So that strengthens your argument.
I think it does. The sudden provocation, I mean, it is something that can happen almost instantaneous. I think this case is kind of a good example of that, particularly with the killing of the woman. He comes in, whatever his intent was before then, and sees her without any clothes on. I mean, he was in a relationship with her, and I think that's something that could snap instantaneous, and then he committed the accident.
But he only sees her because he illegally broke into her house carrying an AK-47, right? I mean, what did the victims do to provoke him breaking into their house to see them naked in their home?
Sure. He goes in there with the intent, when he goes there originally with the intent to threaten one of the victims, sees that she's there, becomes upset because of the lies she told him that she wouldn't be there. That could be provocation. Does that give him the right to then break into the house? No. He does that, and it could be a second provocation.
Seeing her car parked at her residence with her husband is sufficient evidence to warrant instruction on sudden quarrel?
It could be. And this is not the classic example of, I'm going to look for my wife and find her in bed with somebody else. This was an ex-lover of his that they had broken up just a month before. They were still communicating, still talking, still trying to get that relationship together. And I think that the sudden choral provocation, it takes into the fact the human frailties. This is a person in a relationship, a long-term sexual relationship. He's kind of abandoned. He goes there. He still has those feelings that make him lose normal self-control upon seeing her there, seeing her naked with someone.
And you're trying to distinguish a sudden provocation for purposes of a lower offense as distinguished from a momentary thought that the law considers premeditated.
Correct.
Is that the distinction?
I think so.
And
yes.
If that distinction were justified either in the law or the facts, then how would you instruct the jury?
I think you would instruct the jury. I think probably the best way is the way we asked for a definition of sudden quarrel with the language that it can be based upon a sudden happening, the language that's given in Trice and State versus Smith, but include that language that a sufficient provocation couldn't even
be
malice.
So the big picture is you don't want a step instruction starting with first degree. You want two parallel tracks presented to the jury. Is that the structure of the instructions?
If it's a step instruction, I think we have to have that negative element or something saying, look, you have to consider whether there was sudden quarrel based on sufficient provocation, because that negates malice.
And you have to instruct the jury how that gets into evidence and who's got the burden on all the different moving parts.
Sure.
Right?
Would this be different if the defendant did not testify? Because nobody knows what is in the defendant's mind if the defendant doesn't say what was in his mind at the time the crime was committed.
Correct.
So when your defendant testifies that he didn't intend to do this, then your argument is that he should have an instruction on whether or not this was an intent to kill, a premeditation, or whether or not it was the result of a sudden snap in his ego or his psyche that caused him to commit these crimes.
And there could be, obviously, I think, scenarios where a defendant would testify that this instruction would still be required. For example,
if the defendant didn't testify?
If the defendant testified. If he's, for example, sitting at a bar looking at his phone and somebody sees him get angry and throw his phone down and run off and get in his truck, and then he goes and commits a murder. If the phone indicated that there's a message from somebody saying, a spouse saying, I'm off having an affair, I hate you, I'll show you, that would be evidence of the sudden provocation that would justify the instruction, even if the defendant didn't testify.
Is there a difference between sudden provocation and sudden quarrel as it's used in the statute?
I think that sudden quarrel can be in manslaughter, whether there's a sudden quarrel or if it's a unlawful killing during the commission of a non-lawful act. The sudden quarrel is something that brings something up. For example, a bar fight's a sudden quarrel. Sudden quarrel based upon provocation, I think, requires something more than just something coming up. It's sufficient provocation. Although not defined by the law, again, the classic example is you're catching your spouse with their lover. Some people would suggest if you came home and you found somebody molesting your child, that would be provocation.
Well, we've defined it as the sudden happening or occurrence of the provocation so as to render the mind incapable of reflection and obscure the reason so that the elements necessary to constitute murder are absent.
And that's the definition. And that covers a lot of ground. It's pretty broad, but I think it doesn't cover everything. I don't think it covers, I'm just mad at this person because they took my parking spot would be sufficient. But some of the other things we talked about would be sufficient for that sudden quarrel based upon provocation. But I think that's a factual issue for the jury to determine. Is, with the definition you just gave, are these facts enough under that definition to find the person guilty of voluntary manslaughter and not first-degree murder?
And what is it about the specific facts in this case that you think provide a scintilla of a sudden quarrel?
Again, the facts were that Mr. Hendrickson and this woman were lovers for many years, living together. She married somebody else, didn't tell him until later, moved out. They were still communicating, still talking. She had told him she was going to be somewhere else. he shows up and she's there, the lying about where she's being, and then again, finding them together, even though they're now married, it could create that, hey, somebody's with the girl I love, gets your emotions so up that you lose normal self-control.
Somebody who's married to the girl he loves?
The other victim was married to the woman, yes.
But the court did instruct on sudden quarrel, second-degree murder, and manslaughter, didn't it?
In second-degree manslaughter, they did. But again, the jury had no way of applying whether or not the
first-degree
malice was negated.
On your intoxication defense, are you arguing that the statute 29.122 is facially unconstitutional?
Facially unconstitutional and as applied, I would think.
What's your argument as to apply?
In this case, there was sufficient evidence to show that he was under the influence of alcohol such that he couldn't form the intent to commit first-degree murder. Based on the number of drinks he had, his behavior, all the stuff that was in the record. So that the state, because they have to prove intent, he was not allowed to show that there's something that negated his intent, and that violated his rights to due process, to put on a full defense intent.
What would be the reason he carried an AK-47 over there?
The evidence at trial...
He was too intoxicated to know that he was carrying an AK-47?
The reason he had the gun in the car, there were plans that night to go out coon hunting, apparently. This is something that he and his friends had planned to do, had done in the past. That's why the weapon was in the car.
But he took the weapon out of the car to shoot through the glass of the door, to open the door, and then shot through a bedroom door.
That's correct.
So what was that? Was the record in conflict as to whether he was intoxicated? Was there evidence that he was? What's the best evidence that he was intoxicated to the extent that he didn't know what he was doing?
The number of drinks he had over a short period of time, having 10, 12 drinks over a couple, maybe 2 hours. He was at the bar dropping glasses, drinks, trying to do cartwheels. His own evidence was he had to go into the bathroom after dancing and getting dizzy to vomit. I think all that shows that he was intoxicated, and the number of drinks he was having was increasingly getting intoxicated. So by the time he left the bar, he was still going to be more intoxicated because of the number of drinks in the short period of time that he had drank. I think that's the best evidence that he was intoxicated, not able to form the intent. I'll reserve the rest of my time if I can.
Thank you. Mr. Wiss, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Your Honors. I please the court, Nathan Wiss, appearing on behalf of the appellate, State of Nebraska. Primary issue on appeal here is whether the jury instructions were correct. Mr. Heinrichsen asserts that they were incorrect in 4 respects. If time permits, I'll address each of his 4 arguments. As far as the first argument on the first issue, whether lack of sudden quarrel or the negative element of sudden quarrel should have been included as an element of first-degree murder, the state maintains that the answer is no, given that this court already addressed this issue in State v. Morgan and held that the negative element of sudden quarrel is not an element of
first-degree
murder.
Was a due process argument raised in Morgan? Or did we decide it on due process?
I don't recall if it was specifically decided on due process grounds. I would think that when you're talking about jury instructions and the right to be or have the jury correctly instructed, that would necessarily be a due process concern, but I don't recall the specific framework of how that opinion set it out. But we would maintain that Morgan was correctly decided and there's no reason to depart from that decision, especially since it's been on the books for over a year and a half now and the legislature has not responded by changing the elements of first-degree murder, which it could have done if it disagreed with this court's decision. So we would submit that Morgan is controlling on this issue, and the negative element of sudden quarrel is not an element of first-degree murder. On the second issue with the jury instructions, whether the district court gave the correct definition of sudden quarrel, we maintain that it did give the correct definition, given that it gave the exact definition that this court approved in State v. Trice and again in State v. Abdul-Qadir. As far as Heinrichsen's assertion that the district court should have given his proposed instruction instead, which would have said that a sudden quarrel includes provocation which renders the elements necessary to constitute murder absent, we would reiterate that this court specifically disapproved of this language in State v. Trice. And even though Trice was a second-degree murder case, as the appellant points out, there's nothing in the Trice decision which indicates or suggests that a different definition of sudden quarrel should be given in first-degree murder cases. So we would submit Trice is controlling on this issue, but even if it's not controlling, we would submit that it nonetheless would not make sense to give a different definition of sudden quarrel in first-degree murder cases.
We've said that instructing in the language of the statute is sufficient to comply in the first-degree murder cases, and that if the defendant testifies that he didn't intend to kill this person, and that something happened when he went over there and he just snapped, wouldn't he be entitled to have the jury consider whether or not this was the result of sudden quarrel or provocation, as opposed to just having the jury determine whether or not he planned to kill them ahead of time?
Well, the jury will consider that issue if they move beyond the elements of first degree.
Well, you're saying that once the jury determines that he intended to kill them, they don't need to consider whether or not it was a sudden provocation, because those are mutually exclusive.
Right, and not just
But the defendant says, but the fact is in front of the jury that he says, I didn't intend to do that. Wouldn't he be entitled to have the jury consider whether or not he planned this, or was the result of a sudden quarrel or provocation?
Well, again, if
the jury finds what you're saying is that the state doesn't need to instruct on that if the jury is simply instructed that to find whether or not he planned to kill these people ahead of time. Malice aforethought.
Well, right. Given the elements of first-degree murder, it's not just that he intended; it's that there was premeditated malice. And I think both of those definitions, individually and collectively, are completely inconsistent with sudden quarrel. I mean,
right.
Premeditation is to form that design before it's done. Malice means that there's no justification.
But he wants this in the alternative, right? I beg your pardon, Judge. He wants this in the alternative.
Not just in a
proceeding in the step fashion.
That was the proposed instruction, and that's my understanding of what they wanted, was a negative element. Mm-hmm. So we would submit the correct definition of sudden quarrel was given in this case. As far as the third issue, whether the district court gave the correct definition of premeditation, the state maintains the district court did give the correct definition, given that the definition it gave conformed to NJI, and this court has repeatedly approved that definition. As far as Heinrichsen's assertion that the district court should have instead given the instructions set forth in 28-302, the state's response is twofold as set forth in our brief. The first response is that Mr. Heinrichsen did not preserve this issue for appeal, given that he did not object to the district court's definition of premeditation. And our second response is that even if this has been preserved for appeal, his argument is nonetheless without merit, given that this court specifically addressed and rejected this exact argument in State v. Taylor. The Taylor decision has been on the books for over 3.5 years now, so we would submit that, as with the Morgan decision regarding the elements of first-degree murder, the legislature's inaction shows that they agree with this court's decisions. The fourth and final issue with the jury instructions is whether an intoxication instruction should have been given.
Excuse me, how do you characterize the appellant's constitutional challenge? Is it facial or applied or both?
The intoxication.
Yes.
I think I would characterize it as facial, given that they filed a pretrial request seeking an intoxication instruction, but they never did anything afterwards. So I guess my understanding was facial, but I mean, arguably, they don't have to raise an as-applied challenge prior to trial. We're not disputing the fact they could be raising an applied challenge now. So I mean, if Mr. Lancaster is asserting that it's both, we're fine with that. We would submit that an intoxication instruction was properly denied in this case for three reasons. The first reason is that although Mr. Heinrichsen filed a pretrial request 4 months before trial seeking an intoxication instruction, they did not renew that request at trial, they did not include an intoxication instruction in the proposed instructions, and they did not object to the district court's instructions on the basis that an intoxication instruction was absent. So we would submit that this issue was not properly presented below, or at least was not preserved for appeal, given that this court has held that error cannot be predicated on failure to give an intoxication instruction unless that instruction was requested and denied. Second reason, we would submit that an intoxication instruction was properly denied in this case, is that Nebraska has done away with the defense of intoxication as set forth in 29-122, and Mr. Heinrichsen has failed to demonstrate that that statute is unconstitutional. As set forth in the party's briefs, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a similar statute in Montana v. Engelhoff. Engelhoff was a divided decision, as the appellant points out, which means that this court could go with either the plurality or the concurrence's view. But based on the state's reading of that decision, Nebraska's statute is constitutional under either view. So we would submit that even if this issue is preserved for appeal, 29-122 is constitutional and an intoxication instruction was properly denied as a matter of law. And the third reason we would submit that it was properly denied is that as a matter of fact, the evidence did not warrant an intoxication instruction in this case. Set forth in the state's brief, several of the state's witnesses, including close friends of Heinrichsen, testified that Heinrichsen was not overly intoxicated on the night in question.
Wasn't there quite a bit, wasn't there evidence to the contrary to that, too? He was intoxicated.
Well, there were a few witnesses who did, a few witnesses who did not know him as well that opined that he was intoxicated. There's no dispute that he had quite a few drinks and that he was feeling the effects of alcohol and to some extent may have been under influence. But as far as being wholly deprived of reason, which is level of intoxication he must have been at to warrant intoxication instruction, we would submit the evidence did not support that. And his actions and statements on the night in question also show that he was not wholly deprived of reason, especially when he himself told police he wasn't drunk. So we would submit that an intoxication instruction was possibly denied in this case. The only other sign of error in this case pertains to the pictures of Leon Vargas admitted at trial, which show Leon Vargas alive prior to the homicide. I don't have much to add to my brief. I'll just briefly reiterate our response. We maintain that the photographs were properly admitted in this case for identification purposes, given that Lee and Vargas' bodies were burned beyond recognition. And in any event, even if this court were to find that there were any error with the admission of those photographs, we submit that it was harmless. Most of the evidence in this case was not in dispute. The only dispute, for the most part, was Heinrichsen's state of mind. Pictures they had no bearing on Heinrichsen's state of mind. So even if there were any error with the admission of those pictures, we would submit that it was harmless. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has 1:46.
1:46. Mr. Lancaster.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, I want to address the issue of whether the request for the intoxication instruction was preserved. Certainly, the motion filed in advance of trial was a request, and was titled Request for the Intoxication Instruction. That was filed in June, like June 14th, I think, or 12th, a few weeks before trial started. The trial was then continued until October. Hearing was in July. The court's order denying that was in September. That was a requested instruction. It wasn't included along with the other instructions. There's no reason to ask for it twice.
Well, let's talk about that. Isn't the purpose of making the parties raise it at the informal or formal instruction conference after trial, at the end of the trial, to determine whether or not the evidence that's actually presented at trial justifies that? Isn't that the purpose of
that?
That's
the purpose of the conference, but I don't think that a defendant should have to ask again and again and again like
that. Well, but when you ask before trial, you're asking when no one knows what the evidence is going to be at trial. And consequently, that's the purpose, the similar purpose is behind the requirement to raise an objection to evidence again at trial when it's been a motion to suppress has been denied. The whole point is you don't know what's going to happen until the trial's actually occurred. And isn't there a really good reason to insist that that request be made at the conclusion of the trial?
I think if there's a question, so, the attorneys don't ask for things in advance and don't ask for it later so they can say, hey,
want it both ways, which is more or less the federal approach. But that's not Nebraska's approach. Never has been, has it?
I don't believe so, but I think in this case, and I think the law has said, Carlton, State versus Carlton, if you ask for it in advance, that's sufficient to preserve the issue. Particularly with this particular instruction and the nature of it, because of the new statute saying you can't have that anymore, I think it was sufficient to ask in advance, have a hearing in advance. It's clear from the evidence presented at trial that the intoxication was the issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day. Thank you, Judge Bishop. And that case is Williams versus City of Omaha.